Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Alternative to Complaining. Brothers and sisters, don't waste your time complaining. Use your energy to create a solution. If you're not lighting any candles, don't complain about the dark. Sometimes we see people, they're complaining, this is broken, this is wrong, the world is a disaster, the world is like this. But when you look at themselves, they're not really doing anything to solve this problem or the list of problems that they may have. So if you're not lighting a candle of your own, you should not be complaining about the darkness. Complaining is a complete waste of one's energy. Those who complain the most accomplish the least. This is a rule of thumb. You see that, you know, you look at successful people, you would find that there are people who are content. They're not complaining, they're not whining, they're not just, you know, losing hope. And hence they become successful. But there are others who complain and they waste their time and energy in complaining rather than finding the solution, right? Those who complain the most, they accomplish the least. And as you waste your breath complaining about life, someone out there is breathing their last. Always keep that in mind. Appreciate what you have. Be thankful and stop complaining. Live more. Complain less. Have more smiles and less stress. Stop talking about your problems and start thinking about solutions. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about the alternative to complaining. And we said that there are some people who are busy complaining, whining, and they attain, if not nothing, then the least. But those who focus on finding the solutions, they attain and accomplish a lot in this lifetime. Psychology says that when you focus on your problems, you will have more problems. When you focus on possibilities, you will have more opportunities. Repetitive complaining will attract things for you to complain about. Repeated gratitude will attract things for you to be thankful about. Don't let someone dim your light simply because it's shining in their eyes. You see, it really depends on the type of company you keep and the type of role models you have in your life. If you have a company of hopeless people, you know, people who live their lives in despair, and every time you sit down and hang out with them, they just say something like, you know, oh, nothing is fixable, you know, nothing can be amended, this world is a mess, you know, everything in my life is a mess, everything in your life is a mess. These types of people, they pull you into this whole cloud of environment of, you know, hopelessness and despair. So know that you have to stay focused. You have to embrace challenges. You have to know that if there is a challenge in the world, then there is a solution for that challenge. You are the one who can find that solution. You need to be around people who are optimistic and who are ready to face the challenges of life. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
European News Bulletin.
From London. Hello, everyone. My name is Saeed Pourreza. Our top story, more controversy from France. The country's interior minister has announced new measures in the fight against so-called political Islam.
Des parents qui vont voir un enseignant.
Parents who go to a teacher to tell them to stop teaching about cartoons and freedom of expression. Tomorrow it will be a criminal offence, and a judge can say, and this is extremely important, a judge will be able to say, if you are a foreigner, you are condemned to this crime, you can leave the national territory.
The statement comes after President Emmanuel Macron called on Muslim leaders to adopt, quote, Republican values. Macron issued a 15-day deadline for the French Council of the Muslim Faith to draw up a new charter that stipulates Islam is a religion and not a political movement. The new measures will also aim to cut any foreign funding into the country. New restrictions will also come in for homeschooling. Children will be given an identification number to ensure they're attending school. Parents who break the law could face up to 6 months in jail as well as large fines. The government has also announced the closure of the country's largest anti-Islamophobia organization. There has been widespread opposition to the move by Macron's administration, with international critics calling for a boycott of French products. Let's cross over to Paris. Kristen Hahn joins me now with more on that story. And Chris, starting off, where does this leave freedom of speech in France?
Well, the freedom of speech is seriously damaged by this new law, which is not only targeting Muslims, but most of the activist movement, like the Yellow Vest movement as well. Concretely, it says bad intention publishing of faces from police officers will be sanctioned. Now, it's a very strange formula, because it can be interpreted on different ways. Interior Minister Darmanin says there is no problem to continue filming police officers, but members of his own government say the opposite. So anyhow, existing laws are more than sufficient to punish incitement of hatred. So people ask, why is this new law put into practice? It only puts more pressure. It increases the pressure on the social movement and the repression of the social movement in France.
When this whole thing began, it was characterized as a crackdown on Islam and the Muslim community. How has the Muslim community reacted to President Macron's 15-day ultimatum?
Well, they are, they are scandalized. And it's not only the Muslim community. This law is targeting a lot of social activist groups. Many of them, they are victimized at this moment. The ultimatum which Macron asks of the French Council of Muslim Guild to be signed, it's really one-sided, because the same ultimatum is not asked to the famous Council of Jewish Institutions, CRIF, who has established relationships with the Israeli state and who has established relations with far-left, far-right groups like the Jewish Defense League, who has proved committed violence against pro-Palestinian activists in France. These people do not have to sign the same charter of ultimatum. It's really one-sided towards the Muslim community.
And then there's the question of whether or not these measures are productive or counterproductive. Takfiri extremism is a problem, but it seems that the French government are helping radicalize young Muslims.
Well, it's true that since the terrorist attacks in 2015, still the recent beheading of the teacher, the Takfiri extremism is a real problem, and it makes the far right growing. They are not obliged to do anything. They are growing naturally by this kind of terrorist attacks. What is never highlighted is the real problem. For instance, France is one of the most important countries selling arms to the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Emirates, Turkey, which stimulates war in the Middle East, which stimulates directly groups like ISIS. This kind of acts of the French state, of the UK, of Germany is never highlighted in the mainstream press. It's always about the Muslim community, problems of Muslims. So it's really one-sided, and this makes this put an entire community in the corner. I mean, they react like not as a bloc, of course, but they react as victims of a racist policy. So all the racist, mm-hmm. far-right, Islamophobe groups are stimulated by this kind of new laws of the French government.
All right, Chris Ten Hond in Paris for us. Chris, thank you. And now to other news this hour. Azerbaijan's president Ilham Aliyev has met Russia's defense minister Sergei Shoigu to discuss peacekeeping efforts in Nagorno-Karabakh as the ceasefire with Armenia grows stronger day by day. Aliyev praised Russia's efforts and thanked the people on both sides for showing restraint and determination to put an end to the conflict. Russia's deployment was made at the request of Armenia in a bid to maintain peace in the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. The region has witnessed 2 weeks of calm after almost 6 weeks of intense fighting that left many dead. Preliminary results from the parliamentary elections in Georgia show the country's ruling Georgia Dream Party will hold a wide majority in parliament after the opposition boycotted a runoff on Saturday. Opposition parties have been staging regular protests against the results of the first round of elections held October 31st, describing them as illegitimate and unfair. They accused the Georgian Dream Party and its supporters of vote buying, bullying, and court violations. A total of 8 opposition parties have said they'll boycott the second round until a complete rerun of the elections is organized. Well, let's see what's been happening in Twitterverse. Story 1, a new development in the case of desperately needed Venezuelan gold bullion worth more than $1 billion held by the Bank of England. Ahmed Caballo joins me now. Ahmed, tell us why you're highlighting this story.
Well, people say how much of a bad year 2020 has been. Well, if we think we've had a bad year, spare a thought, for Juan Guaido. In 2020, he's no longer the president of the Venezuelan National Assembly. He sponsored a failed coup attempt back in July, and now he owes £400,000 to the British Courts of Appeal because he was unsuccessful in trying to ascertain $1.2 billion worth of Venezuela's gold. Now, what's interesting about this is the British Courts of Appeal have given him a deadline of October the 20th to make the payment. He ignored the deadline, and after the deadline passed, he then said, oh, sorry, we can't pay this because of sanctions. Now, it's interesting because Juan Guaido is possibly the most ardent supporter of US-led sanctions against Venezuela, but now he's more than happy to use that as an excuse.
And you were the journalist who asked him why he was supporting sanctions against his own people on his visit to England months ago.
Yeah, I asked him. I said, if you claim to be the president of Venezuela and you know that sanctions hurt your people, why would you support sanctions? He refused to answer. And I wonder what he would say now. He's using it as an excuse. So Alan McLeod, he's a independent journalist. He says this: Juan Guaido is finding out the hard way what it means to pretend to be a head of state. A UK court has ordered he pay over $500,000 in legal fees for trying to legally claim Venezuela's $1.2 billion worth of gold in the Bank of England. And it's interesting because it reminds me of, you know, when a child pretends to be the parent and then the parent passes them a bill and then all of a sudden the child stops pretending and is like, okay, playtime's over. And this is what it's like. When you're a head of state, it doesn't mean you just get to go to big banquet lunches and big dinners. It means that you have to take responsibility and you have to pay bills sometimes. John McEvoy, final tweet, says, Guaido's legal team has cited US economic sanctions as a reason for non-payment. The same cushion sanctions that Guaido has supported. Shambolic situation.
All right, let's talk about another situation, Ahmed. And this one has to do with something that happened in this country 30 years ago. Now there are new calls for an inquiry into the 1989 brutal murder of solicitor Patrick Finucane in front of his family in North Belfast, Northern Ireland, during the Troubles that claimed more than 3,000 lives. Bring us up to speed.
Yeah, it was possibly the most controversial killing in the Troubles, and the reason is not only because it was done in front of his family, in front of his wife and kids while they had a Sunday meal. Either the gunman stood over him 12 times, so stood over him and put 12 bullets in his head, 14 bullets in total. It wasn't the way that he was killed. It's because there's been strong suggestion that the British state or British state agents were involved. And despite the tireless efforts of Patrick Finucane's family, the British state has avoided a public inquiry, getting to the crux of the problem. Now, David Cameron admitted in the House of Commons that state collusion was involved, yet he still didn't offer a full-fledged public inquiry. And it's quite a big step that now four of the North of Ireland's six biggest parties have come together and said, enough is enough, it's been more than 27 years, it's time for a public inquiry, it's time to heal the wounds that have been left in the north of Belfast from that killing.
And I would consecutive British governments have suppressed like demands for a public inquiry. Will there be one this time around, do you think?
This is the point. So some people are saying that even if there is a public inquiry, it will be a whitewash, because essentially you can't have the state investigating the state. And there are some suggesting that because the role of the state or the alleged role of the state in the killing of Patrick Finucane, that you need to take it outside of the judicial system here in the UK, mm-hmm. and maybe get the UN or international human rights organizations to carry out that investigation.
Right. Well, so bring John us the Twitter traffic on this story, Ahmed.
Yeah, John Finucane, who was the son of Patrick Finucane, who's now an MP in North Belfast, who was there when his father was killed, says this: I welcome today's letter of support from the SDLP, Green Party, Sinn Féin and Alliance for a public inquiry into my father's murder. The British government must respond soon to our Supreme Court judgment. My family and local and international support urge them to announce a public inquiry. Now, Forgotten People doesn't agree, and this is obviously someone from the unionist community. He says, Patrick Finucane relayed messages to and from jails of Republicans. He was at senior provisional IRA meetings along with Gerry Adams. I can't find anywhere where the Alliance Party asked for an inquiry for Republican murders, yet now we have them pushing one for Patrick Finucane. Now obviously I've already explained the difference, because the state wasn't involved in the Republican murders in the north of Ireland, while there's alleged involvement of the state in this one. Final tweet from the Vice President of Sinn Féin, Michelle O'Neill. She says, former British Prime Minister David Cameron acknowledged shocking levels of collusion, quote, in the state killing of human rights lawyer Patrick Finucane. British Secretary of State Brandon Lewis must now do the right thing and hold a public inquiry. The Finucane family deserves no less. And all final right. point, if I have time, this is why the covert...
We don't actually, Ahmed, but make right. it very brief if you can.
This is why the covert human intelligence bill is so worrying, because it essentially legalizes the actions of MI5, the British intelligence community, in things like murder, and sexual assault, and torture.
All right. Ahmed Caballo with those stories. Ahmed, thank you. We stay in this country. Will Britons be allowed to celebrate Christmas with their families this year? That's the question everyone in the UK has been asking for weeks now. Other religious festivities have been unceremoniously cancelled during the pandemic, but today, Prime Minister Boris Johnson addressed the Commons, announcing a break in the COVID-19 lockdown for Christmas.
5 days of festive freedom have been promised families separated for months at a time, on and off since March, when the COVID-19 pandemic began.
I can't say that Christmas will be normal this year. But in a period of adversity, time spent with loved ones is even more precious for people of all faiths and none. We all want some kind of Christmas. We need it. We certainly feel we deserve it. But what we don't want is to throw caution to the winds and allow the virus to flare up again, forcing us all back into lockdown in January.
A health chief has warned England could face 25 days of extra restrictions, though, to make up for it. Boris Johnson is facing a growing Tory revolt over coronavirus rules. Senior Conservative backbenchers are demanding he set out a strategy to avoid a cycle of national lockdowns.
In late October, Boris Johnson scrapped the three-tier system, sending the UK into a full lockdown. According to government figures, the infection rates were soaring and a circuit break was the only way forward.
And it seems to have worked. Daily infection numbers and deaths have reportedly fallen by 15 and 11% in a week. We asked people what they thought of the PM's latest announcement.
Yeah, it's a good idea. But the thing is, people will be getting together. Whatever the Prime Minister says, people will be doing what they want to do.
I think it's a really bad idea. Based on my following of what various scientists are saying, like SAGE, Independent SAGE, just seems like a bad idea.
I understand why people don't want it to happen, because if you've got all the households mingling, it is going to make the infection rate go back up. But I think in terms of mental health and all that, if you have this little bit of a break, it'll make people be able to last a little bit longer. Just the amount of time that they then can go back into lockdown restrictions, because otherwise people are just going to be fed up at the end of the day. I know people are already fed up.
I don't think I will, because it's not like the virus is going to go away for those 5 days or anything like that. I don't think I will be mixing with people and households or anything like that.
The UK will ease out of the lockdown starting December 2nd. A new strengthened three-tier system will replace it, and mass testing in all Tier 3 areas will be rolled out. Meanwhile, the government has secured 100 million doses of a COVID-19 vaccine developed by AstraZeneca with Oxford University.
Subject to that regulatory approval, and I really stress that, because the medicines regulator, it's called the MHRA, is independent, they're rigorous, they're one of the best regulators in the world, and they will be very, very careful to ensure that they look at all the data to make sure that this is safe. Subject to that approval, we hope to be able to start vaccinating next month.
The vaccine is believed to be 90% effective when it comes to reducing transmission. The UK government has also secured tens of millions of doses of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines that are said to prevent getting infected in the first place. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Moving on, dozens of exhausted refugees rescued from drowning in the Atlantic Ocean have arrived at the port of Spain's Gran Canaria island. Three of them needed medical attention and were carried on stretchers and wheelchairs when the rescue boat docked. Spanish Foreign Minister Arancha Gonzalez said his country would be increasing its police presence in West African nations to tackle criminal networks behind an upsurge in illegal immigration to the islands. Nearly 17,000 refugees have made the journey to the Canary Islands this year, 10 times last year's total. In a move that could further escalate tensions in the region, Turkey says it's extending seismic survey work carried out by its Uruç-Reis ship in the disputed waters of the eastern Mediterranean until November 29. The ship had been expected to finish its survey work by November 23rd, but a Turkish naval notice said the vessel would continue work in an area west of Cyprus for another 6 days. The dispute originally escalated in August when Turkey first sent the exploration ship Uruç-Reis into waters also claimed by Greece and Cyprus. More stories trending on social media. In the U.S., militia members, including members of the so-called Boogaloo Movement, holding an armed march throughout Richmond, Virginia. And Richard Sedan has been following that story for us and joins me now with all the details. Richard?
Pretty incredible first story, Syed. So the white supremacist extremist group, the Boogaloo Boys, held an armed march in Richmond in the state of Virginia, basically breaking state laws. This group is literally strapped, they're armed, they're carrying munitions, literally walking past the signs that prohibit them to do so. And of course, this really poses a bit of a serious question, because if the Boogaloo Boys, who actually plotted to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, are allowed to carry guns and break the law, then what is the difference between white supremacism as an ideology and the so-called laws of the land in the United States? That's just a question I am posing. And just a reminder that there's actually situations where black people who are unarmed are literally being gunned down. And you've got a situation here where open supremacists are allowed to parade around with guns, clearly intent on causing havoc and mayhem. I want to go to a couple of reactions online first of all, if I can, Saeed, before we get into this.
Go ahead.
Filmmaker Tariq Nasheed said, deputized white supremacist group the Boogaloo Boys were allowed to defy gun laws today. And we have another tweet here from Strain Asylum who says, the troublemakers are not in Black Lives Matter. They are the white supremacists in the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys, and similar hate groups. Black Lives Matter is not a hate group. Black Lives Matter is not trying to start a race war. It's trying to end one. And just a reminder, the Boogaloo Boys actually believe there's going to be a second civil war in the US. They believe such a war will be predicated along racial lines. And it seems, Saeed, like they're very much prepared for it.
They really do, don't they, Richard? Let's move on to, you spoke of Black Lives Matter. This story takes us to Brazil. Fresh anti-racism protests in that country after the death of a black man at the hands of security guards at a shopping mall. Tell us why we're highlighting this today.
Exactly. So João Alberto Silveira Freitas, a 40-year-old black Brazilian, let's just call it what it was. He was beaten to death by a couple of security guards outside a store. And as a result, there were massive protests, including in the store itself. And of course, it sparked a renewed conversation in Brazil about racism. And people have been protesting along the lines of Black Lives Matter. And it's kind of a reminder, Saeed, really, that everywhere, every corner in the world where colonialism has been exported, including to the Americas, white supremacism, racism, is as rampant now as it ever was. And I think many people are incensed about this and want justice, as you would imagine. Let's go first to Henry online, who says, black man killed by security guards is buried in Brazil. Echoes those of the racial justice movement in the United States. And we have Christy James, who says, a black man was killed by two security guards. It could have been here, but it was in Brazil. A day before, they celebrate Black Consciousness Day of all days, Saeed. Something needs to change.
It certainly does, Richard. Maybe very briefly, racism has been around forever, but what we see now, thanks to technology, smartphones, we get to see what's happening to minority groups around the world. And also, we're looking at civil society reacting to acts of racism more than it used to because of what they can see on a day-to-day basis. Well, looks like we have lost Richard. He can't hear me, and we're going to have to probably leave it there. We're trying to get Richard back on and continue the conversation on that story that happened in Brazil, the death of a black man at the hands of guards outside a massive shopping mall in that country, and the fresh protests that have erupted as a result of that murder. Okay, great. We have Richard back on. And Richard, I was saying that briefly, because of smartphones, because of technology, we get to look at what is being done to black people and other communities around the world. And then as a result, we're looking at more reaction, just like in the form of those protests, whenever and wherever that happens, very briefly.
Absolutely, and it reminds me of a quote that I heard earlier on this summer. I can't remember who said it, but the quote said, racism isn't getting worse, it's just getting filmed. And that's why you're seeing more and more of these instances come to our screens, because citizen journalists, people are basically filming these instances. It's not a new phenomenon, but certainly the camera phone is allowing renewed conversations and is allowing these racist attacks to be caught on film for the world to see.
I couldn't have put it better myself. Richard Sudan with those stories. Richard, thank you. And that's all for now, everyone. Goodbye.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Javdan. Please stay tuned. The true meaning of patience is when someone shows enmity towards you, but you have no grudge in your heart towards him. Patience is when you can take revenge when someone did something bad to you, but you forgive him. Patience is when you control yourself and do not disclose the secrets of a person who damaged you. Now, patience means that you even do not refer to a single detail of somebody who did something bad to you. There is also a situation in which someone else comes to you and talks unfavorably about a person who did something bad to you. If you control yourself and do not talk also unfavorably about that person, then you can be called a patient person. This is how we stop the fire of grudge and revenge inside ourselves. This is how we stop our souls from being fired.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Color Islam Page, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Jafdan. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/Ian Kalawislam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. جنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing presently about the qualities of the pious people based on the sermon number 184 in Nahjul Balagha. This sermon has got other names too. It's also called the Sermon of the Pious People or the Sermon of Hammam, who was one of the people who had asked Imam Ali alayhi salam a question regarding who the pious people are, and Imam Ali alayhi salam explained to him. And of course, you know that later on that Hammam was so overwhelmed by this sermon that he lost his life. His soul left his body. Anyways, we come to our topic for today. Today we are going to discuss about one of the other qualities of the pious people, which is that tarahu qariban amaluh qalilan zalaluh, that a pious person is one of the qualities of the pious people is that their hopes are short, their hopes are nearby, clear, and you can say they are not far-fetched. That is the part we discussed previously in the previous 2-3 sessions.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Today we are going to discuss the other quality which is mentioned in this phrase, which is qalilan zalalu, that their mistakes are few. So their mistakes are few, the mistakes of the pious people are few. But I would say that if you look at this phrase properly, there is some kind of connection between the two qualities. First, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that you will see that their hopes are short. They don't have long hopes. They have clear-cut goals that are practical, that are realistic, that are based on true and fundamental principles. Then he says, قَلِيلًا زَلَلُ. Their mistakes are few. See, what is a mistake? A mistake is a wrong action, an action that is not supposed to be done. Imam Ali alayhi salam says that the pious people are those whose mistakes, that means those wrong actions that are not required to be done, are extremely few. And this makes sense because when a person has got long hopes, doesn't have clear hopes in his life, has different aims that are all flowery, then his mistakes will also be more and more. Because he will act in accordance to those aims that are futile, that are just figments of his imagination, and therefore will be always stuck in the different mistakes that he makes in life. Sometimes it may cause confusion to him. Of course, you know the famous story of that lady who was carrying a pail of milk on her head, and then she started to think that I will sell this pail of milk and I will buy eggs, and after that the eggs will hatch and I'll get chickens, and then the chickens will grow, and then I will sell those chickens and I'll sell the meat of the chickens, and after that I'll buy goats, and then I will become a shepherd and I'll have a big farm. So we notice that she made so many of these big pictures in her mind. Her aims and hopes are so long and unrealistic that she made a mistake. What was her mistake? She stripped and fell off, and the whole pail of milk just dropped onto the ground and got wasted. And this is a very good story, actually. It tells you that in life you need to have clear hopes and clear-cut and firm hopes. If you do not do that, then the chances of making mistakes in life are many.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when we say that the chances of making mistakes are many, is because, as I said, the aims are not clear. The aims are long. They are futile, or rather I can say they are far-fetched. Therefore, the decisions that a person makes in their lives or in his life are quite connected to these aims that are there in his mind. This is one of the reasons why the pious people do not make mistakes, because they have very clear-cut, strategized hopes in life. Therefore, their errors are very less. First of all, their aims are correct and true because they have the right awareness about their purpose of life. They know that their purpose of life is God, to achieve the perfections that Allah has applied for them, has allowed them to achieve, has encouraged them to achieve. And at the same time, they follow those processes and those steps properly. They have guides, they follow the guides, the guidance of the guides, and are shown the way. In such a situation, the mistakes become very less. Unfortunately, sometimes we notice that a human being, or there are certain philosophies that have now come about, that they want to live this life under the basis of trial and error. Trial and error, so a person keeps on making mistakes until finally he achieves his goal in life. First of all, who knows that his life will be so long that would allow him to make all these trials and errors until he reaches the objective, firstly. Secondly, who knows that maybe this will be a constant, regressive cycle, or regressive, continuous chain, whereby a person will continuously commit mistakes and will never achieve his aim. And this is when a person bases his whole life on the fact that I need to make mistakes, then he is wrong. But if a person knows that I need to reduce my level of mistakes as much as possible, but at the same time, if I make mistakes, I don't have to lose hope and I have to make my heart firm and seek forgiveness. That is a positive attitude. So let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He allows us and protects us from making errors and mistakes in our lives. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
In the limelight. Rural American healthcare systems entered the coronavirus pandemic in already precarious financial positions. Over the years, shifting demographics, declining revenue, and increasing operating expenses have made it harder for rural hospitals to stay in business. The pandemic has made it even more difficult. In mid-March, most rural hospitals in the United States halted elective procedures to slow down the spread of the virus, cutting their revenue further, and many have faced price gouging for supplies given extreme shortages. Dr. Jennifer Bacani McKinney, who practices family medicine in Fredonia, Kansas, said, "The community is tired, frustrated, and stubborn. Politicians talk about relying on personal responsibility to end the pandemic, but I don't see a majority of people wearing face masks in public spaces, despite pleas from health professionals. Some people are scared, others act as if COVID-19 doesn't exist." We're prepared for you an article written by Lauren Hughes. The piece is titled, "U.S. Rural Hospitals Are Facing Unprecedented Challenges Amid Worsening Pandemic." The article has been taken from the truthout.org website. Please stay with us for more of Lauren Hughes's article. It's difficult to put into words how hard COVID-19 is hitting rural America's hospitals. North Dakota has so many cases, it's allowing asymptomatic COVID-19 positive nurses to continue caring for patients to keep the hospital staffed. Iowa and South Dakota have teetered on the edge of running out of hospital capacity. Yet in many communities in rural America, the initial cooperation and goodwill seen early on in the pandemic have given way to COVID-19 fatigue and to anger, making it hard to implement and enforce public health measures, like wearing face masks that can reduce the spread of the disease. Rural healthcare systems entered the pandemic in already precarious financial positions. Over the years, shifting demographics, declining revenue, and increasing operating expenses have made it harder for rural U.S. hospitals to stay in business. The pandemic has made it even more difficult. In mid-March, most rural hospitals in the United States halted elective procedures to slow the spread of the coronavirus, cutting their revenues further, and many have faced price gouging for supplies given extreme shortages. "We work with rural doctors and hospital administrators across the country as a researcher, and we see the stress they're under from the pandemic. Here is what two of them," Connie Martin, Chief Executive Officer at San Luis Valley Health in Alamosa, Colorado, and Dr. Jennifer Bacani McKinney, who practices family medicine in Fredonia, Kansas, are facing. Their experiences reflect what others are going through and how rural communities are innovating under extraordinary pressure. Dr. Connie Martin from Alamosa, Colorado, said, COVID-19 fatigue is real. It's wearing on people. Everyone wishes we were past this. I read the other day about healthcare workers being the keeper of fears. During COVID-19, patients have disproportionately placed their fears on clinicians, many of whom experience the same fears themselves. I focus on building resilience, but it's hard. Dr. Connie Martin noted, my hospital currently has 7 patients with COVID-19 and can make room for as many as 12. Back in spring, we converted a visiting specialist center into a temporary respiratory clinic to keep potentially infectious patients separate and reduce pressure on our emergency department. It's all about making sure we have enough staff and hospital capacity. Dr. Connie Martin added, there isn't any hospital that isn't under siege, which means that getting patients to the right level of care can be a challenge. In the past few days, we have accepted 3 transfers from facilities that are on the front range. We've never had to do this before. With 6 intensive care unit beds and 10 ventilators, we are trying to help others. She added, influenza hasn't arrived yet in our community, and I worry about when it comes. We have nearly 40 staff out right now on isolation or quarantine, a staggering number for a small health facility. We are having to shift staffing coverage in half-day increments to keep up. She continued, we are not at a point where we are even contemplating bringing COVID-19 positive staff back to work, like the governor of North Dakota suggested. I hope we never get there. However, we are considering high-risk versus low-risk exposures. If a clinician is exposed to COVID-19 during an aerosolizing medical procedure, that's high risk. If a clinician is exposed to a classroom of 50 people who were all socially distanced and wearing face masks, that's low risk. If we face critical workforce needs, we may bring back healthcare workers that have had low-risk exposures. Dr. Connie Martin added, we have gained a lot of knowledge this year, and we all feel wiser now. But definitely, we feel older too. Dr. Jennifer Bacani McKinney from Fredonia, Kansas, said, we chose to live in a rural community because we look out for one another. Our one grocery store will deliver to your home. Our sheriff's department will drive medications outside of city limits. If we could return to our rural values of caring for and protecting one another, we would be in a better position. Somewhere along the way, these values took a back seat to politics and fear. Dr. Jennifer Bacani McKinney said, Wilson County, where I practice in southeast Kansas, didn't see its first COVID-19 case until 15th of April. By August, you could still count the number of cases on 2 hands. But by mid-November, the total was over 215 cases in a county with a population of about 8,500, meaning about 1 out of every 40 residents had been infected with coronavirus. She added, our 25-bed critical access hospital doesn't have dedicated intensive care unit beds, and it has only 2 ventilators. Emergency department calls are split among the 5 physicians in Fredonia. In addition to dealing with COVID-19 cases, we're managing every other illness and injury that walks through the door, including strokes, heart attacks, traumatic injuries, and rattlesnake bites. She added, "We have sectioned off a hallway of rooms for suspected COVID-19 patients. However, without an intensive care unit, we have to rely on other hospitals. Recently, my partner had to transfer a patient who had a gastrointestinal bleed. She had to call 11 different hospitals to find one that could take the patient." She added, "I feel lucky to have on-site testing in the hospital laboratory, but like many of my rural peers, getting enough face masks and other personal protective equipment early on was tough." Dr. Jennifer Bakani-McKenney added, "The community is tired, frustrated, and stubborn. Politicians talk about relying on personal responsibility to end the coronavirus pandemic, but I don't see a majority of people wearing face masks in public spaces, despite pleas from health professionals. Some people are scared. Other people act as if COVID-19 doesn't exist." She added, "Politics is making things harder. I have been Wilson County's health officer for the past 8 years. This year, county commissioners gained more control over COVID-19 health decisions." She added, "When I proposed a face mask mandate early on in the pandemic, one county commissioner argued it would violate his rights. Another commissioner balked at one of my reports, saying I had no right to tell schools how to evacuate kids before they can return to sports, despite the health risks," adding, "I recently proposed a new face mask mandate given our rising numbers. I explained that masks could not only save lives, they would help businesses stay open and keep employees at work. The commissioners voted it down 3-0. Dr. Bakani-McKenney added, "We live in an interconnected world where commerce and people cross state and national borders, and with that comes the risk of new diseases. America will face another pandemic in the future for sure. Rural healthcare delivery systems can leverage lessons from COVID-19 to prepare. Among other things, their emergency preparedness tabletop exercises can include planning for infectious disease outbreaks in addition to fire and floods, mass casualty incidents, and chemical spills. They can permanently diversify supply chain options from other industries, such as construction industry and agriculture industry, to help ensure access to needed supplies. To avoid staff and supply shortages, they can create regional rural healthcare networks for swapping staff, conducting testing, and acquiring supplies. Meanwhile, doctors in rural America and healthcare administrators are being as flexible as possible and resourceful as they can in the face of adversity."
The naval fleet of Iran Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently received a new domestically built ocean-going warship capable of carrying aircraft, drones, and missile defense systems. The heavyweight multipurpose vessel, which has been designed for long sea journeys, joined the IRGC's Navy during a ceremony on Thursday. The 4,000-ton warship, which is 150 meters long and 22 meters wide, can carry drones, helicopters, and operational vessels, as well as missile, air defense, and radar systems. It is named Shahid Rudaki Warship after martyred IRGC Navy Commander Abdullah Rudaki. The vessel is equipped with three-dimensional phased array radars, surface-to-surface and surface-to-air missiles, advanced communication systems for electronic warfare, and a Khordad 3 air defense system, all of which are designed and put into operation by Iranian experts.
The main actual issue for the armed forces is to be strong enough to defend the country and to retaliate any possible attack against Iran. So that is part of that. And since